Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up on a farm in southeast Iowa, got a degree in zoology, and joined the Navy. He rose to the rank of 3-star vice admiral, and in 2002 became the 53rd chief of personnel in naval history. As such, he was responsible for the planning and programming of all manpower, personnel, training, and education resources, budgeting for Navy personnel, and the deployment of over 800,000 Navy personnel. His name? Vice Admiral Gerald Hoeing. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to 3-star Vice Admiral Gerald Hoeing. Jerry, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you very much, Jack, and it's my honor to be a part of your show.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, you bet. I was born on I was raised on a small farm in Iowa. We had a little over 200 acres. We had some cattle, some hogs, mostly raised corn, soybeans, alfalfa, and things like that. My job was to milk the cows in the morning and pick up the eggs from the chickens virtually every day. That was part of my chores, and it was that childhood and the opportunity to live and be raised on a farm, I think, that actually got me started in the right direction in my life.
What did you learn from your mom, and what did you learn from your dad?
Well, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, as most mothers on farms in Iowa was at that particular time. What I learned from her is the value of sticking with it, to keep at it, to keep working and working and working until you got to where you really wanted to be. She did that every day, either in the house or sometimes when the crops were getting ready to come in. She would work in the field right alongside us and just stuck with it all the time. My father was pretty strict. He believed in, he was very, very morally focused. He believed in hard work every day, and I believe that I learned from him the value of putting everything you can into the jobs as you go through your life, because he certainly put his all into virtually everything that he did as I was growing up as a kid.
Looking back, what did growing up on a farm teach you about your naval career?
Well, as a small family, I had one brother also, plus my grandparents lived on another farm. In fact, we helped farm that farm also, just a few miles away. We did everything together as a team. The family worked together. We always worked together. When it came time to put in hay or some major effort, the whole neighborhood pitched together. So instead of us trying to put in our, hay, we would end up having all the neighbors, one of them would do the baling, and we would all work together, and we'd get the hay in the barn. The ladies would all come together in a potluck style and operate as a team and feed everybody. Of course, the food was great. We had a lot of fun, and the work got finished. That's what the Navy is all about, operating on aircraft carriers, surface ships, submarines. That whole crew has to come together because everybody has their place. I think I learned that on the farm back in Iowa.
You get a degree in zoology, and then you join the Navy. Why?
Well, I went to Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. I went there on a Navy ROTC scholarship. The only reason why I got interested in the Navy in the first place was two reasons. One is one of those neighbors that I grew up with, his name was Harold Sams, and he just passed away a little less than a month ago. He had been in the Navy in World War II on a Jeep carrier, an escort carrier, and he had these fantastic stories about combat operations and about the teamwork on the ship and his friends and the ports and the hardships of at sea and also the joys of successful mission accomplishment. He talked to me about the Navy. I got this bug that says maybe the Navy is what I ought to look into. And when I had the opportunity to apply for a Navy Reserve Officer Training Corps scholarship, it seemed like a match. So that got me off to Iowa State, and I majored in zoology because I enjoyed that field. But what I really majored in was the United States Navy. I focused so much on the ROTC courses and developing myself for a successful career in the Navy, zoology was a stepping stone in order to get there. So I guess what I would say is, yes, my technical major was zoology, but in my heart, my major was the United States Navy, and I did everything I could to prepare myself for that career.
You never went to the Naval Academy. You start in the ROTC, and you have this meteoric rise, 3-star vice admiral. How did that ever happen?
Well, an ROTC graduate on the scholarship program, like I was, has essentially becomes what we call regular Navy. In other words, it's not a reserve commission, even though it's called the Reserve Officer Training Corps. When you get commissioned as an ensign, you're commissioned in the United States Navy, not the Reserve. The same as the Naval Academy. They're commissioned USN Vice, USNR. Over the course of the last 40 or so years, the role of ROTC and officer candidate school officers in the Navy has expanded greatly. It used to be very difficult to become a senior officer unless you were a Naval Academy graduate, but that's changed over the years. For example, the chief of naval operations that just left the Navy a little over a year ago, Admiral Vern Clark, was born in northeast Iowa in Sioux City, was raised in Quincy, Illinois, and he went to officer candidate school and rose to be the most senior officer in the United States Navy without that Naval Academy background. So I think, from an anything is possible perspective, today, anyone, whether they're a Naval Academy graduate, whether they're an officer candidate school graduate or an ROTC graduate, or quite frankly, an enlisted sailor that starts out in the enlisted corps of the Navy, has the potential of becoming the chief of naval operations, just like our CNO of a few years ago.
We're talking to Vice Admiral Gerald Hoeing, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Jerry Hoeing. Jerry, growing up in southeast Iowa, the biggest mass of water you saw was a pond. And then you go to the Navy, and you're out on these oceans for 3, 6, 9 months. Talk about that adjustment.
Well, it was pretty simple. Obviously, a big difference between living on a farm in Iowa or going to college in Iowa and going into the Navy where we went on deployments. But we did have the Mississippi River. It was right there by my hometown. No, just it was an easy adjustment. It was a job. We were focused on the mission. I was flying off of aircraft carriers, learning how to be as good a pilot as I could possibly be, flying jet aircraft off of, at that time, USS Constellation. So, the fact that this runway that we were operating on happened to be floating at sea was not necessarily, you get used to it after a short period of time. So it was a great opportunity. The mission is what kept us focused. So being at sea long periods of time was easy to overcome.
During your career, you had one mission after another. What did you do during Operation Desert Shield?
Well, that was a particularly interesting part of my career. It was my first opportunity to be in command. I was the commanding officer of VFA 81, the Sunliners, stationed out of Cecil Field in Florida. My job was initially XO. We transitioned from the A7E Corsair to the FA-18 Hornet. In fact, the Hornet, the airplanes that we're flying off of our carriers today. And I became the commanding officer, and we deployed on the, believe it was the 4th of August. Iraq invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August, if I remember correctly. So my job was to lead the squadron and prepare them for combat. We spent about 4 months prior to the actual combat operations operating in the Red Sea, practicing the strike profiles that we would be flying in combat should we eventually go into combat. And my role was to make sure that my pilots and the entire crew that prepared those airplanes for flight were ready for those operations. I actually left the squadron just a couple months before Desert Storm, the actual combat operation, started.
In January of 95, you became the 20th commanding officer of the USS John F. Kennedy. Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, what a tremendous honor to have the opportunity to command John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy is CV-67. It's a conventionally powered aircraft carrier. I'd been flying off of aircraft carriers as a pilot for my entire career. Now to have the opportunity to command the ship and be responsible and accountable for the more than 5,000 young men and women that made that platform operate was absolutely tremendous. We integrated women into the crew during my command tour. Prior to that, there had been no female crew members on board that particular carrier. And we also had the responsibility of taking the ship that was undergoing an overhaul and bringing it back to life. It had been in the shipyard for 2 years. Now getting the ship underway, under its own power, to a new home port, and then establishing the capability of the ship to where it became combat ready and combat capable again was a tremendous task, a tremendous challenge, but all 5,000 plus of those folks are working together in order to achieve it.
Let's follow up. When the Navy decided to integrate the ships with female personnel, female crew, that wasn't a change, that was a transformation. No doubt you had a lot of doubters. How did you make that happen, and how did you get the males to accept that, Jerry?
Interesting enough, when this happened in 1995 and finished up in 1996, women had been integrated onto ships for a few years prior to that. So there were a lot of lessons learned on the proper ways of doing it. There had been some mistakes made in the past. There had been a lot of lessons learned, and we were able to capitalize on all the positive experiences that other ships had had and be able to minimize or eliminate some of the other experiences that some of the other ships had had where they had run into problems. Let me give you an example. One of the things that was some of the ships did early on was they would take the best possible berthing compartment and transition it to women when, in fact, they didn't then have enough women on board to fill the berthing compartment. What we learned was to make them movable back and forth. Sometimes it may be a male berthing compartment, sometimes it may be a female berthing compartment because the composition of the crew shifts over and over. Bottom line was it had been done before. We learned the lessons of the past and put them into place, and it was a tremendous success on John F. Kennedy because our women became absolutely crucial parts of our crew, and we got along extremely well, and everybody was on board, and we were successful with it.
Looking back, what was the most pleasant surprise or value that you didn't even dream about?
Well, the men and women worked together so very, very well. That was a real plus. But sometimes the women brought more to the table than the men in certain areas. So we were able, in whether it be technical or whether it be administrative, in many cases, our women crew members stood up to the plate and just did a tremendous job and were essential in our success for the future.
You know, we might have some female listeners tonight, Jerry, saying not sometimes, but women always bring more to the table than the guys. So, it's 2002, and you become the 53rd Chief of Naval Personnel in the Naval history. You've got a staff of 1,500 people, and you become responsible for over 800,000 Naval personnel. Can you start to talk about that?
Well, I believe that my career path for what in the Navy, when you're at sea, you call that sea duty. When you're ashore, you call it shore duty. From essentially right after my command of VFA 81, I left command there in 1991, all of my shore duty was associated with human resources, manpower, personnel training, or education. I became a the director of Naval Aviation Junior Officer Distribution. I later went to work for the Secretary of Defense, actually for the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, learning the policy issues associated with manpower, personnel, training, and education. Later on, I became the Director of Distribution in the Navy, and eventually, just prior to becoming the Chief of Naval Personnel, I had been the Deputy Chief of Naval Personnel and the Commander of the Navy Personnel Command. The result of that was years of building experience and exposure to the very complex nature of manpower and human resource management. So I felt like I had been groomed for the job of Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, Manpower, Personnel, Training, and Education, long title, and the Chief of Naval Personnel, because I had all that experience and exposure before and a passion for doing this sort of work.
When we come back, we'll ask Vice Admiral to continue to talk about being the Chief of Naval Personnel. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Vice Admiral Jerry Hoeing. Jerry, a month or so ago, as you know, eight of us from the Detroit area got to spend 2 days on the Big Stick, the nuclear aircraft carrier, the Teddy Roosevelt. 5,500 crew members, average age 19 and a half. They're out on that Atlantic Ocean for 6-9 months at a time. All of us said one word best described the experience, and that word was trust. The teamwork, the trust. They're working 7 days a week, 16, 18 hours a day. Can you talk about the trust in the Navy?
Well, we live on trusting your shipmates. As you saw firsthand by being able to go out to the Theodore Roosevelt and see them doing their operations, you know that let's talk about the flight deck, first of all. On the flight deck, you have yellow shirts directing aircraft. You have brown shirts getting the airplanes ready for launch. You have green shirts doing maintenance. You have white shirts doing safety. You have purple shirts doing refueling. It just goes on and on and on. Everybody has their job out there, and everybody has to succeed in accomplishing that job. You have to have trust that the maintenance person is going to have the aircraft ready for the air crew. You have to have trust that the fueling process is going to go well. You have to have trust that the safety inspections are going to take place correctly and that the airplanes are, in fact, going to be safe for flight. That's what we're talking about, is teamwork where everyone trusts each other. It's like a baseball team. You have to make sure, you have to trust that the shortstop is going to be able to snag that hot grounder and make that throw to first base. And these young men and women on the flight deck of that ship and throughout the ship, through the engineering spaces, the admin spaces, the aircraft repair shops, they trust each other that they're going to make that snag and make a perfect throw every time, because in many cases, their lives depend on it.
Each one of these planes, the cost is $60 to $80 million. The average age of those 5,500 kids was 19 and a half. Nothing went wrong, Jerry. How do you explain that?
Well, it's because of trust. It's because they are well-trained. They are certainly motivated. Now, I didn't go out there with you, Jack, but I'm sure that what you saw when you visited the people, walked through the shops, they were all excited about the work that they were doing. They were mission-focused. They understood their role, and that's because they were well-trained, they were well-motivated, and they were well-led. Well-led sailors, just like well-led military people in any organization, and quite frankly, in industry also, what they will come together and work together as a team because they can deliver more as a team than they can as a bunch of individuals.
When we come back, we'll ask the Vice Admiral, what makes a great leader? And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Vice Admiral Jerry Hoeing. Jerry, in your opinion, what makes a great leader?
Well, leaders have to be dedicated and motivated, no doubt about that. They have to understand that as a leader, you are actually serving those that you lead. I believe that all successful military leaders, and I would say also, though I don't have the experience there, that the same sort of thing applies in industry and the civilian sector. As a leader, you have to serve those that you lead because, as we talked about before, it's that team that's going to be able to deliver the total capability of your organization.
Can you talk about the Navy as a career today?
I think that the opportunities for career in the United States Navy have never been better than they are today. First of all, during the last several years, our recruiting success has been phenomenal. We have brought wonderful young men and women into the Navy. Remember, it's an all-volunteer Navy, and they're volunteering to serve their country. Our reenlistment rates and our officer continuation rates have been amongst the highest in history, and I believe there's two reasons. One is there is that obvious opportunity to accomplish a mission that is important to the nation. And the second is, from a personal perspective, the opportunity to have a career that leads to continuous improvement of self while helping meet the needs of the nation. They work hand in hand. The career opportunities are unbelievable, and the challenges associated with those career opportunities are extreme, but that is good because our young men and women want to be challenged. They want to work hard. They want to succeed. They want to do well, and the United States Navy is a great place to do it.
Can you talk about the change in the young sailors in the last 10 years?
I certainly can. I went to a lecture once where a gent talked about the current generation, and he called them the millennial generation. And the theory here is that generations repeat themselves after four generations. We had the greatest generation, the World War II generation, followed by what they called the silent generation. That was the Korean War time frame. Then came the baby boomers of the Vietnam time frame. Then came Generation X, and now we have the millennials. If this theory is correct, the millennial generation is much like the greatest generation of World War II, now that we're in this fifth cycle. And I believe we see this. We see drug use is down, teamwork is up, cooperation amongst the sailors and the young men and women out there on our ships is I believe, at an all-time high. And it's because These folks believe in the higher ideal. They believe in the mission. They believe in teamwork. They believe in coordinating and cooperating. And as a result, I believe that our young men and women are amongst the finest, if not the finest, that I have ever seen in my career of 35 years in the Navy.
Many, many times you've gone into Bethesda Naval Hospital to talk to and spend time with the injured soldiers. What have they taught you, Jerry?
Well, it is an incredibly invigorating time to go in and show respect and honor those that have been wounded in combat or injured in a combat scenario. These young men and women, almost to a person, can't wait to get back to be a part of the team that they came from. I remember talking to a young corpsman who had been injured. I believe he was had been injured in Iraq, and he could not wait to get back to his unit because those were his Marines that he was working with, that he was responsible for. And just to see that dedication and the commitment and honor that those guys show for those that they work with on a daily basis is absolutely incredible, and it reinvigorates those like me that have the honor of going in and spending some time with them.
You talk about their positive attitude in spite of all of their challenges. How do you explain that?
It's incredible to see it. They're just that positive attitude has to come from the team, from the camaraderie, from the closeness of their friends, realizing that their shipmates, their squadron mates are still out there in harm's way. I believe that positive attitude is out of honor and respect for them.
We all use a term, all civilians use this term, close enough for government work. Within the military, do you guys ever use that term?
I use that term all the time, used it all the time on active duty, and now that I have transitioned from the Navy to my position down here as the president and CEO of the Naval Aviation Museum Foundation, I still use it because sometimes the 85% solution is good enough. You can spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money trying to get to 100%, but on the battlefield or in combat operations or in flight operations around the flight deck, there are some things that you have to have 100% on, and you very clearly identify those. There are others that you just have to get the decision over with and move on because so much depends on the timeliness of getting it done. So, yep, every once in a while, close enough for government work is good enough.
A few years ago, you gave the cornerstone article in a magazine, Diversity Inc. And you start out by saying in that article, diversity is much more than just race and gender. What else is diversity?
Oh, it's much more. Diversity has to do with the way you think, the way you bring your individual thoughts and ideas to whatever the challenge is, whether it be in policy development or in tactic execution. The way you think, the way you approach things, the way you solve, the way you adjust, the way you move, the way you lead, that is all diversity. When you take a look at the United States Navy today, you see people of all races, all ethnic background. You see people of both genders all working together, bringing their own individual approach to a team or a corporate effort. And I believe that's diversity. We need people thinking differently about issues rather than everybody thinking the same way. If everybody approaches something from the same way, then you end up with a very narrow view.
We're talking to Vice Admiral Jerry Hoeing, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Yeah. You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Vice Admiral Jerry Hoeing, who retired from the Navy in February of 2006 and is now the president and CEO of the Naval Aviation Museum Foundation. Jerry, a little more than a week ago, Michigan lost a legendary icon, Bo Schembechler. And he had one mantra: team, team, team. You've said many times that nothing gets done without teamwork. Can you talk to us about teamwork?
Bo was an absolute legend. Bo was a leader. His teams were successful year after year after year because of his leadership and his serving those teams so that those teams worked together and were successful as a result of it. That's what it's all about. And I believe that that's what we see on our ships, in our squadrons, in our submarines, in our units overseas. You know, the same basic principles are there. Strong leaders develop good teams work together, and become successful at what they're trying to accomplish.
There's a term also out there, the Browning of America, that by the mid-century, the majority of Americans will be non-white. Can you talk to us, what advice would you give us about diversity?
Well, I would say remember when we talked about diversity, diversity is much more than just the color of one skin. The fact that the United States of America will be have a larger population of non-white than white is inconsequential. They are still Americans working together as a team, and we have to look at it that way. It's America, it's a team, it's our nation working together, bringing different ideas, different thoughts, different approaches to problems, but working together for the greater good of our country.
For a listener tonight that starts out from very humble beginnings and has a huge dream within their heart, what would you say to them?
Pursue that dream. But don't just think about it and hope about it. We use the terminology all the time that hope is not a course of action. A course of action is when you lay out a strategy, you lay out a plan in order to achieve that strategy, you execute that plan to as much precision as you possibly can, and you follow through on every aspect. I believe that if a young man or woman out there has a huge dream, that if they strategize on how they're going to achieve it, plan on executing that strategy, execute it the way you planned, and then follow through, you will be able to achieve those dreams and probably even more.
After a 35-year brilliant career in the Navy, you retired in February of 2006. Can you talk to us about your new chapter?
I have a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. It's not a job, it's an opportunity down here in Pensacola, Florida, as the president and CEO of the Naval Aviation Museum Foundation. We are the economic engine behind the National Museum of Naval Aviation. The National Museum of Naval Aviation is a national trailer. It is a national treasure. It essentially shows the history and the development of this national arm of our military might, naval aviation, from its humble beginnings in the early 1900s all the way up through our most modern warfighting aircraft, the F-A-18 Hornet and the F-14 Tomcat sitting out here on our ranch. My job is to make sure that we educate our young Americans throughout the nation about naval aviation, to show them some of the spectacular historic aircraft that we have, and to also to help educate them in the area of math, science, engineering, and technology so that they will develop those skills and potentially have the opportunity to serve their nation in a technical way in the future, whether that be in naval aviation or some other technical aspect that will help them be able to serve as they get older and continue to serve their nation.
How can we learn more about the Naval Aviation Museum?
Well, first of all, if you have the opportunity, especially during the winter in Detroit, to come down to Pensacola, Florida, please come and visit us. It's in Pensacola. It's on board Naval Air Station Pensacola, Florida. And our climate is great. It's a beautiful area. And this is a wonderful museum. By the way, it's the third largest in the world of its type of an aviation museum. We also are developing this new proposal called the National Flight Academy, where we will have an in-resident program for kids to come. So these are kids 7th through 12th grade to spend time in the museum, in our National Flight Academy, learning about math, science, engineering, and technology using aviation as the teaching methodology, the teaching medium. It's a wonderful opportunity because our nation is falling behind other industrialized countries in our relative performance in math, science, engineering, and technology.
A lot of people in Michigan are looking at the need to change careers at age 40, 45, 50. You went from being a Bo Schembechler within the Navy to now this new role where they didn't even know you. Can you talk about starting over?
In many ways, I'm not starting over because I've lived in naval aviation for my entire career, so being able to step in and carry on the tradition and educate on the tradition in naval aviation is relatively simple. This is a leadership job, and I was trained from a leadership perspective, but it is an entire new community. But think about this. As a person in the military, every 3-4 years, sometimes 2 years, you get ready to move on to another position. So I believe that people in the military are trained to do that also. And people are people. I have wonderful, wonderful employees here. Some of them have spent some time on active duty in the Navy. Many of them have not. But people are still people. They want to be led. They want to have a part of the mission, and they want to be able to achieve their dreams. And I think you can do that in virtually any place you choose.
Is the American dream still alive?
Absolutely. It's alive in all over this nation. So many opportunities out there, so many huge dreams just waiting for people to reach out and achieve them.
Final question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, the advice that I would give them is that anything is possible. that find the dream, figure out the dream, and then use that strategy, planning, execution, and follow-through process to achieve it, because if you don't do it and work with yourself in order to achieve those goals and those dreams, it won't happen. You have to lead the way.
Jerry, for all of our listeners, I want to say thanks for sharing with us tonight. Thanks for 35 years of great service to the United States of America.
Jack, thank you very much. It's an honor to speak with you this evening.
Our guest next Sunday will be the Notre Dame legend, Dan Rudiger, better known as Rudy. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoiler.